Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 30th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, insights into uranium age dating, the geometry of the brain, and a look at the replicability of scientific experiments, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Age estimates of the Earth and its components are based on assumptions about the behavior of trace isotopes over time. But what if those assumptions are inaccurate? A report this week argues that the commonly referenced ratio of uranium-238 to uranium-235, a key parameter in calculating the age of ancient rocks, is too high and should be adjusted to reflect natural isotopic variations. Lead author Joe Heath spoke with me about why this particular ratio is important.
Well, when we want to calculate the age of a sample, we have to use some fixed parameters or constants, if you like, when certain age equations. And uranium-238 to 235 ratio is one such parameter. So we also use certain assumed ratios to correct for our measurement biases that occur during mass spectrometry. So when we refine this value, we're able to subtly impact all previous uranium lead age estimations. And these range from the oldest materials and rocks on Earth that formed over 4 billion years ago to much younger rocks that are hundreds of thousands of years old. So the uranium lead system's also been used to improve the accuracy of other radiometric dating techniques like the argon-argon, lutetium-hafnium, the rubidium-strontium, and the rhenium-osmium methods. So ultimately, this ratio has quite far-reaching implications for determining absolute time in both geological and meteoric materials. For the past 35 years, the geochronological community have largely used an invariant 238-235 ratio of 137.88 to calculate terrestrial mineral ages. And in this study, we've directly determined a new value of 137.818 plus or minus 0.045.
So this is an extremely widely used geochronology tool, this ratio of uranium-238 to uranium-235. How far back in time do we think that it can actually accurately measure the age of rocks?
Well, we can use the uranium lead dating technique to analyze samples of a very wide range of ages, from the oldest solids that formed early in the history of our solar system, about 4.567 billion years ago, through to samples that are much younger and only hundreds of thousands of years old. So this new value has the ability to influence samples that have formed through much of the history of our planet.
So how was this, the ratio that has been conventionally used within geochemistry, this value of 137.88, how was this original value established?
Well, that value has been widely adopted for use in geochronology, and it was established by a consensus vote during a conference back in 1977. Over the intervening 3.5 decades since the consensus vote occurred, researchers have largely come to accept the 137.88 value, and they routinely used it in their work, pretty much without question and with zero uncertainty. However, as the high-precision analytical methods that we've developed in recent years came online, we're now able to better resolve more detailed age information than in the past. And that led us to look back at the fundamental 238-235 ratio again and to try and improve it if possible.
So in your particular study, you name a number of processes that occur during a rock's formation that might actually lead to a different uranium-238 to uranium-235 ratio than what was established. So what are some of these processes that would give rise to different amounts of these isotopes?
Well, processes that can give rise to the natural variations in the ratio have been demonstrated in a few recent studies, but they primarily result where redox reactions occur within low-temperature environments. Some quite significant fractionations of more than one part per thousand have been detected in chemical precipitates and seawater sediments like corals, speleothems and other types of carbonates, as well as banded iron formations and shales. So it's likely that some redox fractionated material may have become incorporated into the magmatic systems that these minerals have crystallized from. The uranium fractionation can also occur in response to the alpha decay of the now long extinct and short-lived curium-247 isotope that decayed to uranium-235 and was present during the earlier solar system. Such fractionations have recently been detected in the oldest objects from our solar system, carbonaceous chondrite meteorites, and in their calcium-aluminum-rich inclusions.
So basically, you've been able to measure a lot of these earlier processes with a lot more precision, and this is why you think that this isotopic ratio should be changed.
Yeah, there are three main reasons why we think that the value should be changed. And firstly, as published, the consensus value of 137.88, it can't actually be traced back to international standard units like the kilogram. However, our data are linked to SI units because they were measured using a gravimetrically calibrated tracer. And secondly, the old consensus ratio had no uncertainty assigned to it. The uncertainty that we've assigned to our value of plus and minus 0.045 at the 2 sigma level, that relates to our measurement uncertainties and to the variability that we observe between different samples. So this ratio is not really invariant as it was previously considered to be. And thirdly, the previous measurements were all made on materials like uranium ores and not on naturally occurring uranium-rich minerals that are routinely used for uranium-lead dating studies. And this is largely because the minerals we've analyzed are both chemically and physically robust and quite difficult to dissolve in sufficient quantities during our processing steps. They also generally have low uranium concentrations, and because of the sensitivity limitations inherent to state-of-the-art equipment, we had to overcome all of these obstacles for this work.
All right, so essentially you propose changing this value, this uranium isotopic ratio, from 137.88 to 137.818, plus or minus an uncertainty of 0.045. This seems like a really minuscule amount. If this new value were accepted, what are its implications on the rock ages that we've already determined for, you know, much of the Earth?
Okay, well, one of the great things about the uranium-lead dating system is that with the two parent isotopes, uranium-238 and 235, and the two daughter products, lead-207 and lead-206, we can actually get three different ages. So while that all can be slightly confusing, it's a great strength to the uranium-lead system because we can use the agreement of all three dates to check the minerals have been closed since their formation. But in general terms, a major effect for this work will be to decrease all previous uranium-lead age determinations. And the magnitude of the shift will be up to 700,000 years for 207, 206 lead ages.
Wow.
They're about 4.5 billion years old. That's the age of the Earth. So to put it into a human perspective, if you could imagine the Earth was about 18 years old, we've taken the equivalent of one day off its life for the oldest materials. For younger samples, where we tend to use the uranium-238 lead-206 dating scheme, the effects is much less and dependent upon a sample's age. So this means now we have the ability to have much greater confidence in our uranium-lead dates that are used to calibrate the timing and the rates of a variety of geological processes, from the initial formation of our planet, the continents and economic mineral deposits, through to past evolutionary events and climate changes. And the cost of it will be a slight increase in the uncertainty that we can assign to a mineral age. And the agreement that we've observed between our results and those that were previously published on high-temperature formed rocks and meteorites also indicate the new average value and uncertainty we've determined may be representative of the Earth's bulk uranium isotopic composition.
Sounds like quite a shake-up.
Yeah, so it's going to shift all of geological time by a small amount.
Great. Well, Joe Heese, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joe Heese and colleagues report on uranium isotopic compositions in a report this week.
Want more science in your life? Check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Science Magazine, where you can read highlights, join discussions, or take your best shot at our weekly quiz.
On the surface, the brain may look like a wrinkly, disorganized mass, but we know, deep down, that it must be awfully complicated. How else would we even be able to ask the question? In a report this week, Van Wiedien and colleagues reveal that the fiber tracts of the cerebrum form a curving grid made up of three-dimensional sheets. I spoke with Wiedien about how this kind of brain plan can help further study.
This was an investigation of the three-dimensional structure of the pathways of the brain. When scientists have thought about the pathways of the brain for the last 100 years or so, the typical image or model that comes to mind is that these pathways might resemble a bowl of spaghetti, separate pathways that have little particular spatial pattern in relation to one another. Using magnetic resonance imaging, we were able to investigate this question experimentally. And what we found was that rather than being haphazardly arranged or independent pathways, we find that all of the pathways of the brain taken together fit together in a single exceedingly simple structure. They basically look like a cube. They basically run in three perpendicular directions. And in each one of those three directions, the pathways are highly parallel to each other and arranged in arrays. So instead of independent spaghettis, we see that the connectivity of the brain is, in a sense, a single coherent structure.
Okay, so when you say, you know, pathways or tracks, what are we talking about? What is this grid made of? Is it gray matter, white matter, just the top of the brain?
This is the structure of the white matter of the brain. At a cellular level, the white matter consists of axons, and there are several billion axonal connections in the brain. These axons are bundled together into large-scale structures, and so what we're describing is the architecture of the three-dimensional structure that all the axons form.
So you applied a different technique than has been used in the past to look at these structures. So first, can you tell us about your technique and how it might be superior to what's been used before?
The technique we used has two parts. The first part is a magnetic resonance imaging technique called diffusion spectrum imaging. This is a mapping of tissue fiber architecture, and it's basically programming the physics of the NMR camera to detect the random movement of water molecules. By detect, what I mean is actually map the three-dimensional pattern or three-dimensional shape of the water motion at every point. Given that image, it's then possible to go through a series of mathematical steps that infer the most likely pattern of nerve fibers in the brain to have produced that diffusion pattern. So the diffusion is a tracer, a non-invasive tracer for the architecture of the tissue, and that's diffusion MRI.
And so how is that better than how we've viewed the brain before?
Well, when you view the brain with a conventional CAT scan or MRI scan, and you take a slice through the brain, what you see at any one point in one of those images is not just one little type of tissue. At every point in the brain, you may have, well, typically three or more different tissue components. The fibers cross. They cross each other and interpenetrate at a microscopic level. So diffusion imaging allows you to disassemble that crossing structure and identify the real components of the brain, the real anatomy.
When I look at the images that you have with your paper, they're beautiful, but they don't look like grids to me. They look more like woven structures or baskets. How is this a grid?
That's an excellent question. In every little location, a woven structure is grid-like. The way that the woven structure is a single grid is simply that it's very curved. The data indicate that in embryological life, there is a very simple grid that exists in the simple developing nervous system. That nervous system is shaped like a tube, and the part that's stated to be the brain is shaped like a plate on the back and top of this tube. And presumably, there is a very simple grid structure in that tube. And then it gets deformed and tremendously curved by the processes of development. So the grid that you see in the developed, complicated, folded brain is simply a highly curved and folded version of a much more literal grid that existed back in embryological life.
So you looked across several species in the study, and you found a lot of parallels in these grid structures. What does this say about the way our brains evolved?
Well, the similarities show, first, that you can generate really complicated brains from a very simple structure on which some simple transformation rules act. You can actually see by going along the series of more complicated brains from let's say, the squirrel monkey or owl monkey, which is a little New World monkey with a not-folded brain, mm-hmm. up to, let's say, the rhesus monkey, which is a much more complicated brain, and finally to the human, you can see how the more complex structure emerges in layers on top of the simpler structures by a process of repeated folding and elaboration of the basic pattern. Now, this is of considerable interest to people who are looking at the genetics of the brain. You know, one of the big surprises to have come out of the Human Genome Project has been just how few genes there are that produce us. The number is in the few tens of thousands rather than in the hundreds of thousands. Well, this is highly compatible with that observation that a very simple set of developmental steps are sufficient to generate a very complicated structure.
This kind of brings up another topic that I wanted to touch on. You looked across several different species, but if you looked at different people, would you expect to see large differences between the way these grids are arranged?
This is precisely the future objective that we have now. We're also part of a consortium called the Human Connectome Project, and that project is devoted to mapping the human brain as a prelude to diagnostics. And the basis of a diagnosis is comparing one brain to another. So we think that this grid structure will greatly accelerate this process of comparison. But you asked a specific question, which is, how do I think the brain may vary from person to person? The thing that people previously considered to be fiber pathways might better be considered local condensations of the grid structure. And so the variable that we would anticipate finding would be different degrees in the distribution of grid components in the brain. You measure them and, one piece is larger here, one piece is larger there. And this is a question that's going to have to be addressed by imaging many hundreds of normal subjects from every subject population that we may have access to. And that's definitely in the works.
Very interesting. So what are some of the advantages of having a gridded system like this in the brain?
People have theorized that parallel processing can do things that single processors can't do, that they can be a more powerful type of computer when you have connections running coherently as an array rather than just as individual wires. But it was a puzzle how that array-like structure could get started in our brain. People had to say things like it develops in early childhood. But now, from this structure, we have good reason to think that the brain is pre-designed to make it very easy for that kind of structure to emerge. Arrays of parallel wires of equal length will naturally transmit coherent volleys, coherent in space and time. So this picture of the brain is more than just a longitude and latitude of the brain and therefore, highly potentially useful, but it also contains, or favors at very least, but may contain a model for how the brain works, how the brain evolves, develops, and what the brain is.
Van Weeding, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
You can see images of woven brain fibers in the report from Van Weeding and colleagues in this week's Science.
How many times must an experiment be repeated before it can be accepted? Should scientific journals publish replicated data? Such questions are raised in response to two difficult problems for the scientific endeavor: fraud and a bias towards positive results. In a News Focus this week, Siri Carpenter explains the ambitious project developed by a group of psychology researchers to determine just how replicable some experiments really are. Carpenter spoke with me about the story.
There's a group of about 50 or so psychologists, some faculty, some grad students, calling themselves the Open Science Collaboration, and they're trying to replicate a large sample of studies recently published in leading psychology journals. And their goal isn't to put individual studies in the hot seat, but to start to get an overall sense of whether the field might be getting too many false positive results, and if so, what can be done to fix that. And so far, there are about 30 replication studies underway. And Brian Nosek, who's coordinating this project, he's a psychologist at the University of Virginia, says that he's hoping that enough people will become involved that they can do substantially more studies over the course of the next several months.
So what has led them to think that there might be too many false positives in the psychology literature?
I think that there are a number of psychologists who've been expressing concerns about reproducibility for a number of years. Everybody recognizes that, like in almost every other field of science, psychology journals are much more likely to publish positive results than negative results, which means that negative results typically just get shelved, and that in turn means that the field can easily develop a skewed picture of how robust and reliable any given effect is. So just because of that publication bias alone, which isn't going to go away, there's already a big risk for having a high rate of false positives. Then there's a whole suite of research practices that could further inflate that risk of false positives, like running a lot of studies with too few research participants, or including a whole bunch of tests but then only reporting the results of some of them. So some psychologists had been thinking about how to assess just what the extent of the problem is and if there is a problem, how to fix it. And then what really brought the issue to a boil, I think, was a couple of cases of scientific misconduct that have been very high profile in the last couple of years. Most recently, the case of the Dutch social psychologist Diederik Stoppel, who has admitted to fabricating data for dozens of studies. And then another thing that rattled the field was the publication a couple of years ago of this set of experiments that claimed to find evidence of precognition, or the ability to see the future. And the finding itself was obviously really controversial, and it's one of those kinds of extraordinary claims that demands extraordinary evidence, as the saying goes. So a lot of psychologists were really disturbed when it turned out that the journal that published the initial precognition findings, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, that journal's explicit policy, in fact, is to not publish replication studies. So those events kind of brought the whole issue of false positives and replication to a head and prompted this reproducibility project, as well as several other things in the field where psychologists have been trying to sort of look inward.
So these fraudulent papers by the Dutch psychologist Stoppel, it just seems like bad luck that this happened to be in the field of psychology, and these other controversial papers, it happened all the time. I mean, is this really a problem only for psychology?
That's right. Fraud can happen anywhere, and there's no evidence that fraud is any more common in psychology than in any other field of science. What a lot of psychologists feel is that the real thing that is threatening psychology's credibility is not fraud, which is rare. It's something much more mundane, and that is that there are research practices that are the norm in psychology that can lead to inflated rates of false positive results without anybody doing anything that is dishonest or willfully deceitful or any form of scientific misconduct. And that's a problem that exists in other fields of science as well. This is a concern in the biosciences, in computational science, and in many other fields.
Now, what I'm curious about is why reproducibility is such an open question right now. It seems like reproducibility is one of the main tenets of scientific experimentation, of the scientific method. Why aren't more experiments reproduced and replicated in the first place?
That's a great question, because you're right. Reproducibility is very often held up as a key facet of science, and it is. But it is the case that direct replications, where experimenters try to mimic the conditions of an original experiment as precisely as possible, are very rare. And the reason is because journals very rarely publish them. They don't tend to be seen as the same sort of intellectual contribution that other kinds of research are. And there is no reward for a young scientist who is trying to get a job or get tenure or get funding.
Now, how straightforward is it to reproduce someone else's research? This project that you spoke about, when they're trying to replicate these earlier research studies, I mean, is that really as straightforward as it sounds?
Well, I think that's one thing they're going to find out. And, you know, the first question is, how easy is it to obtain the necessary materials to do a replication study? Another question is, how easy is it to actually create the conditions that were present in the initial study? Another question is, how easy is it to figure out just what would constitute a replication? Those are all things that this group is going to be learning as they go. They're just getting started, but what I've been hearing so far is that they're having overwhelming success in obtaining people's original materials, Only a couple of researchers have declined to provide original materials that would be needed in order to do a direct replication. It remains to be seen how easy a time they'll have creating the conditions that would constitute a direct replication.
So these positive responses they've been getting from these original researchers, are these the same sorts of reactions they've been getting for all experts in the field?
I think it's really mixed. From talking with psychologists, there are people who feel like this is a great and necessary project. There's been a lot of discussion and worry about reproducibility and about false positives in psychology, and this study is an important way to try to start to get a handle on just how big a problem that is. There are other people who feel like questions about false positive and questions about the lack of direct replication overall in the field is a concern that's been overblown, and they don't necessarily feel that the study is problematic, but they don't feel that it's necessary. Then I think that there are some people, and I don't know how many, but I would say that there's at least a minority of people who feel like this study has the potential to damage the field in the sense that it could make psychology look bad, that psychology is a field that's sort of already under siege. And if the results of the study come back saying that there is some disturbing level of non-replication, that will make it look bad for psychology.
So when will we begin to start hearing the results from these replication studies?
I think that they probably won't be publishing results until sometime, my guess is next fall or next winter. There are still people joining on to the project. Anyone can join at any time. It's an open science project, so all of their discussions and methods and everything are publicly available on the web. There's a public Google group. And I think that they will be continuing to add studies into the mix at least over the next few months and maybe longer. I think it's kind of an open question just how big it will get.
Great. Well, Siri Carpenter, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Siri Carpenter writes a news focus entitled Trust But Verify in this week's Science.
Finally today, we have Jane Lee. She's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. First, we have a story on a new drug that shrinks tumors in mice.
Yes. So researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine were looking at specific proteins on cancer cells called CD47. It's basically a signal telling the body's immune system not to attack it. Normal healthy cells display it, and it's sort of their way of tagging them as friend versus foe for the body's immune system. But what these researchers did is they targeted this protein and came up with a drug that basically blocks this CD47 and found that the body's immune system could be coaxed into attacking and destroying these cells. They did this first in a petri dish and saw that it eliminated these cancer cells.
So the cancer cells were kind of using this tag as camouflage.
Yes, and so this treatment strips away that camouflage or blocks it. They took it the next step further and transplanted human tumors, like breast cancers and bladder cancer cells, into the feet of mice. Because apparently this is a good way of monitoring tumors in mice. And they treated these mice with this anti-CD47 drug and found that in most of the cancers that they looked at, it either shrank the tumors or got rid of them completely.
That's an amazing result. Did they see any side effects in the mice?
One of the side effects is that the body started attacking some healthy blood cells, but they found that the mice were able to replenish those cells despite the attacks.
So what are the next steps for this research? Is it on to people?
Yes. So the researchers at Stanford have gotten a $20 million grant from the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine to move these results into humans and to see if this will actually work in humans on cancers.
Sounds promising.
Yeah.
Next up, we have a poisonous fog story. What's going on there?
Yes. So fog is a big part of the ecosystem along California's central and northern coasts. Researchers have found that this fog contains high levels of mercury. So what researchers at the University of California at Santa Cruz did was they went around and collected fog.
How did they measure this mercury in the fog?
Well, first they collected the fog, and so they have equipment that just slurps up a certain amount of fog, and it keeps all the suspended particles within that fog. And so from that, they are able to analyze the concentrations of the different chemicals and compounds in there, and found that the levels of mercury were about five times the highest concentration that they've ever seen in rainwater.
So how can researchers use this information?
So California isn't the only area with fog in that, and it's not the only ecosystem that relies on fog. And so looking at potential places where this could be a problem is, I think, it's a good realization to know that fog can be so highly contaminated with mercury.
Last up, we have a story on some new information on the makeup of the moon. What can you tell us about that, Jane?
One of the hypotheses explaining how the moon came to be is that a Mars-sized object collided into the very young Earth and spewed out a bunch of magma that then coalesced to form our moon. And based on computer models of the physics involved, the models say that about 40% of the moon should be made up of this other Mars-shaped object. But when researchers analyzed moon rocks, they find that compounds in the rocks are identical to compounds in Earth's crust.
So the moon looks a lot more like the Earth than you would expect if it were made up of part of this giant impactor.
Right. They figure this out by measuring what are called isotopes, and it's basically, you know, atoms like oxygen or titanium. They have different versions and varieties, and they can measure the ratio of one variety to another. Those ratios are different on different planets, so they can tell that this material likely came from the Earth.
So what's the new evidence here? What do the researchers find out about the moon rocks?
So the researchers looked at a new isotope ratio. They looked at titanium because it's not as volatile as oxygen would have been, which is what previous researchers have looked at, and found that the titanium isotope ratios were the same from the moon rocks and from Earth.
So a lot of people are pretty attached to this model of the impactor origin for the moon. Does this new evidence on titanium isotopes, you know, throw that away? Or are people going to stop believing in that?
So I don't think it's going to completely rewrite how people think about how the moon formed. Some researchers are pretty sure that the moon formed from leftover bits from a collision. It's just they need to work out the details. And I think this paper is sort of pointing that out.
Okay, Jane, so what else do we have on the site this week?
So we have some really neat stuff. There's a story on dolphin mafias, and that's how male dolphins form relationships and what they use them for, so that's pretty cool. There's another story on there about a new way to sequence DNA. It's supposed to make sequencing faster and cheaper. There are a couple companies working on that. On our policy site, Science Insider, we have a story on a Russian satellite that scientists were hoping would stay aloft to help with communications from Antarctica. So you can check that out. And then our live chat this week, Thursdays at 3 p.m., is about personalized medicine. So be sure to check out all this and more on our website.
Great. Thanks so much. Jane Lee is a contributor to our online daily news site. You can check out the latest news in the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the March 30th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.